Welcome to Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. On today's podcast, we're talking with Martha Guzman, who's one of the most interesting and influential people I know from the Central Valley. Martha has spent most of her 25-year career working in state and federal policy and politics to make government more accessible and to build more political power, according to her bio. And she started her career working for the UFW, the United Farm Workers Union, and has risen through the ranks to hold positions such as being a commissioner at the California Public Utilities Commission, where she was appointed by former Governor Jerry Brown, and most recently as the former President Biden appointee to head the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency for the Region 9 office here on the West Coast. And I met Martha when you were working in Ledge Affairs as the director of Ledge Affairs in Governor Brown's office way back when. So it's been fun to know you for, I think, a decade now. And I love watching the moves that you've made and how you're always scheming to create a better world. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Danielle. It's been nice to see you evolve too in the traditional print always covering the Valley. I really appreciate it.
Where are you from in the Valley?
I'm from Sacramento.
You are from Sacramento. Yeah. Okay.
But I have a lot of family in Fresno because my dad's mom, my grandmother, Lala, who passed away, and my dad's sister, and at one point, my dad's sister and all of her family live in Fresno.
Got it.
A lot of good memories, summer, and a lot of good food.
Yes, always. So we're just going to start. Let's start talking about PG&E rate increases. Why not? Big topic here in the Valley. So we saw 6 rate increases from PG&E last year. There's another proposal on the table to raise rates again. What can you just describe for people in lay terms? What does this actually pay for when they ask to raise rates?
Oh, that depends on what their application says. Mostly a bill is broken down to the actual energy costs, which we call generation cost, the transmission costs, which is the big highways of getting the power to and from different regions, and the distribution costs, which is everything else, with obviously the distribution lines, but also a lot of the O&M. And then at a smaller level, there's like what we call the public purpose charges, which, for example, cover the subsidy for our low-income families and programs like environmental programs as well. Some of them are funded through that. And traditionally, there was usually, back in the day when the utilities were vertically integrated, the larger costs were maybe more on the generation side, where you would see things having to get built or rebuilt or rehabbed. And so there was constant investment going into that. Then they were decoupled and the generation costs continue to increase, but at a rate that's probably at a 1 to 2, 3, maybe at most percent. And what we're seeing now with wildfires in particular is that the transmission costs and the distribution costs are really the ones that are growing at an exponential rate. And I want to applaud the legislature and the governor for acknowledging this and really trying to focus on that. And there is an effort right now that is underway to try to garner even more systematic ideas about how to get a handle on these costs. Yeah, I mean, I'll stop there.
Can I ask you, I want to back up a few steps here. And can you explain for people, because it's a little opaque, how investor-operated utility, how it creates rates and how that works with the California Public Utilities Commission. Can you maybe chart a diagram for us so we can understand and listeners can understand how this whole system operates? Because later on, we're going to talk about public utilities and it'd be a good contrast to be able to have a picture.
Okay. Yeah. And also because you're covering most of the Valley, right? Not just Fresno. So it varies on where you live. And just like big picture, about 80% of Californians get their electricity through a private IOU, right? And we refer to those in some contexts as publicly regulated utilities, and which is a weird nomenclature because oftentimes we think public, you think, oh, it's like a elected board that's managing it, right? And so then the other 20% is served by what are more traditional public utilities. So everything from Los Angeles Department of Water and Power to Sacramento Municipal Utility District, And in the valley, we have some irrigation districts that are power providers. And so those usually are elected bodies. And there's, depending on where you are in the state, there are actual representation issues there as well. But that's the general sense. And so as opposed to a publicly elected body where you increase rates and you go to the board and the board says, here are our rates, and they have to abide by the public process of noticing and all that. And if people don't like the rates, they can go after and elect somebody else. And in the IOU setting is that the governance of those bodies are a board member, and they have their bylaws and their obligations to their shareholders. And they also have obligations that are derived by statute and by regulation. And in the case of California, by constitutional law too. So that's where they have to essentially, for any augmentation in revenue that they want to collect from customers, from ratepayers, they have to get approval from the Public Utilities Commission. And here in California, the Public Utility Commission is made up of 5 members appointed by the governor, and we have terms. And I think at this point, all of the commissioners sitting have been appointed by Newsom, but they stagger. So there was a good time where there was half Brown, half Newsom, and before that, so forth.
How do you feel about that appointment process for members of the utility commission? Do you think there's other ways to do it, or do you think that's the best way on the table that we have right now?
It has its pros and cons. It goes lame answer, I know. But for example, in my last job, as Danielle mentioned, I was working a lot in Arizona. Arizona has a public service commission that is elected. And when we have our, when you are elected, it depends on your politics. And for example, the renewable portfolio that we have in California does not exist in Arizona. They are renewable friendly there, but it is a different approach. Now, PUC didn't do the RPS and eventually the 100%. That was state mandated. But the PUC has essentially the administration, the governor picks somebody with the mindset and the accountability that he or she is going to live by. I don't know. I think that it doesn't necessarily get you necessarily what you might think. So I think it's a good exercise to look at some of those bodies. Now, this last election, one of the most exciting things that I saw was down in Georgia, where their elected public, I forget what the terminology is, but their PUC essentially had for the first time, I'm not going to remember if they got the majority, but they got 2 seats that they never had with a progressive agenda. And it was really important down there. And they had a lot of different issues, some similar, like they had some nuclear power issues that were really expensive and mismanagement and things like that. So a little different issues, obviously. Yeah, I think it varies. And this is a time in our history where we should all be questioning is are many of our democratically elected systems are being changed are they the best systems? We have this fundamental thing ingrained into us as Americans that democracy is the best model. And I certainly do still continue to believe that, even though it yielded the result that we're dealing with right now. And we need a lot more changes to keep up with our democracy. Really, it's we got to get on the Citizens United case. We got to get corporations out of government. We're almost distracted when we're talking about some of these other measures where it's like we need some fundamental change here, which is getting that type of wealth and the 1% running our decisions and across government. Yeah. And what we're seeing on the redistricting front, obviously, is like another example of how our democracy is in complete flux. And will it yield more representation? Actually, my cousin Boyle from Fresno texted me this morning with this scenario of like how the Texas redistricting could actually completely flip on its face. And it depends on how the Latinos, one, vote, actually turn out, and secondly, vote progressively. And it could actually mathematically have the complete opposite effect of what the Texas Republicans want. But that depends on a lot of factors. So anyway, I got off topic there, but just to say that representation and how we actually represent the people and the needs that they have is a very critical question. And I think the PUC, like many government agencies, can be not accessible. I think a silver lining of COVID was that I was just laughing with one of my fellow commissioners last week, and that we have these evidentiary hearings and things like that. And we have even just what they call a pre-hearing conference to set the timeline for the hearing and the schedule and all that. We used to not be able to do that virtually. And it's just like a non-substantive thing that we couldn't even do virtually. There's some silver linings with COVID, and that was like it pushed us into the internet reality of accessible, and it created accessibility. When I was a commissioner, I remember I had a pre-hearing conference in Fresno because I said most of these people are going to be in the valley. Let's make it more accessible. And it was like so outside the realm of the normal there that it became like a controversy. Yeah. So I think we're past that now. We're definitely past that. And we should go even further. The democracy question is a real one. And as we deliberate on these more systemic solutions on the process, we could do a lot better with what we have today.
Can I ask you a follow-up to that, Martha, real quick? Sorry to interrupt you, Donnie. I think transparency is definitely something that I've read about and being important. But I also wonder about the balancing of the kind of dual commitments of the utility commission mm-hmm. to make sure that PG&E is economically viable, but also mm-hmm. to protect ratepayers. Mm-hmm. And that seems like those two can conflict often. So how do you think about making decisions in light of those dual kind of roles that you serve?
Yeah, and I want to go to the transparency thing back too, but let me just say also as a point of like on the looking at the water sector, for example. The public utilities in the water sector are almost the inverse of what we have with energy, because whereas with water, over 80% of Californians are served by their public utility in terms of a city or a special district, and only 17%, I think it is nowadays, are served by private water utilities. So when I think about inherently in the governance itself, those private water utilities are also responsible to their shareholders. And it's a very interesting dynamic, as Danielle, having worked on drinking water issues and still being able to contribute a little bit to that. In some instances, even with that dual obligation that those IOUs have, I can say that they stepped up equally, if not more, during times of crisis, connecting communities when they were completely out of water. And the Valley has a lot of examples of this, where, you know, to put it in juxtaposition, like the State Water Board had to mandate certain cities to consolidate their neighbors when they were out of water. They had to mandate it. And that took a longer time. And whereas some of the IOUs, because they were not driven by our kids playing against each other on Friday night football, they're driven by the dollar. And they said, yeah, we can do this. Here's how much it's going to cost. State subsidize it. Get that. Like the pace and the interest, because it was purely fiduciary and not your neighbor that your cousin used to date or whatever. You don't have those politics. It actually they've done a lot. Now, you know, also, the other dynamic that is much more of a problem in the water area, by the way, is the ability to have programs like the low-income programs that we have in electricity, like CareFera, is more limited because of Prop 218. And so Prop 218 needs to be reformed so that people can have affordable water, especially in cities where there's economies of scale, for people in Fresno could benefit from a low-income program. People in Salinas, people in Bakersfield, people in Visalia is private. But the privates have that. They have a low-income program. So when West Goshen was consolidated during the drought, they were able to, there were higher rates, but they were also able to benefit from the affordability programs. Once again, I think that it has to be regulated. Of course, sometimes there's actually a benefit to having just not just being purely financially driven, but Yeah, you can't just let it be like the primary even. It cannot be above customers. And that's, I think, where the bigger tension is. That is it when we see some of these decisions. And let me jump over to the transparency question, which goes to your first point, or maybe you made it, Jordan. Six rate increases in a year. I've been telling this story recently because I'm like, maybe there's something here. But when we started with in the Jerry Brown days, we were in a really bad deficit. And for it took almost 2 years, I think, before the legislature would send a bill. They negotiate the budget, and then the legislature would send a bill, and they'd say, okay, we actually, it's late, whatever, August, we're going to send you this $300 million appropriation for some awesome program. And the governor was like, we already negotiated the budget. You can't just come in and, in this case, ask taxpayers to pay another $300 million because it's already been collected. Like, we don't have any more. There's a cap in the revenue that you know of in an annual discussion around what to do with that revenue. And we don't have that sort of structure on the PUC side. And it took the governor a year, almost 2 years of vetoing just with discipline. Any bill that was outside of the budget that had an appropriation was vetoed. And so it created a real tough job for the legislature to prioritize all expenditures at once. And when we have six applications a year, we're not doing that. We're not. We tried to, when I was there, we tried to do like a process. There was like an addendum that had to be included in every application about the marginal increase on the rates and all this stuff. But really, in terms of weighing, at one point towards the end of my time there, I wasn't voting for things that, were really difficult decisions. But like, I remember one time it was a really hard one because I obviously, not only do I respect, I love my colleagues that I served with. And I remember one time it was an electric vehicle infrastructure charging application that the utilities had. And it was like, this is like, again, outside of the GRC, outside of anything really. And it was like another, I don't even remember, let's call it 100 million. It's probably more than that. And I didn't want to do it anymore. It was like, we just did one. Can we? And I don't know, for example, I don't know that the solution is necessarily that everything goes into the GRC, like in terms of the policy, like the policy decisions or anything like that. But definitely we need to, like, by the way, as we talked about earlier, the generation costs are not included there. So you're still not seeing the whole picture. The closest thing I have to the whole picture is when, and this is in credit to Commissioner Florio set this up, is that with a transparency tool that he helped develop, which is called the annual energy true up. And we would see at the end of the year, okay, here's the 40 revenue authorizations and where we're pooling it, and then the transparency. And but when I talked earlier about there's a lot we can do in the meantime, that's a huge thing we could do. We can create discipline on all of these applications. And what does that look like is a great question that we should answer together and put in place, because we don't have the ability to say, would you put a dollar in a low-income program or would you put a dollar in electric vehicle infrastructure charging?
And so it's this sort of fragmented landscape of decisions that aren't being evaluated. Yeah. And people, I mean, you've probably heard it all a lot all the time. We certainly hear it in Fresno. People are just done. They're done. And they're turning off their heat and they're using barbecues to heat their house and all sorts of crazy things to make it work. And what do you think are the biggest barriers to getting back to a level of affordability? And can we even get there? Or is it more a forward-looking, how do we make sure rates don't continue to go up? Like, how do you see the systemic barriers to that conversation playing out?
Let me go really esoteric on you and then come back, because one thing I don't want to get folks confused about is the need to transition all of our economy to electrification, even in the face of this very real thing that we got to figure out, which is the high rate of increase. And that is because when you look at just the reality of our global system of, and right now we're in a crazy reality as a nation to be abundant in oil and natural gas. But as a state, particularly on the natural gas side, and increasingly on the oil side, as we saw through the debates that came out throughout this last 2 years, is that we are importers for the most part, especially on the natural gas side. We import, I think, I don't remember, 93%. It's something up there, right? Have to check. But what does that mean? That means we are vulnerable to these alternatives and the pricing of those alternatives. And we haven't seen it. It's a whole other market that is really uncontrolled. It's not regulated by us. We have no, very limited capacity. It's why Aliso Canyon has been such a critical piece of being able to manage price spikes in the natural gas sector. And we need better tools than that, really. And ultimately, the best tool is to not depend on it and to depend on our own electricity. That doesn't mean we don't import it, but we're generating most of our electricity. And we hope with, and again, credit to this administration, we hope to generate even more, as you all know, on the west side of Fresno. I mean, that the ability to have real physical ownership of our generation is something that is going to provide us cost containment. And in a much more macroeconomic view of the world. So I just want to make sure we don't forget about that, because when we start to talk about how to get through this time, there are a lot of interests that want to just push for an extension of our reliance on fossil fuels. And so we obviously know the climate reasons not to do that, but there's a real economic reason not to do that for the long run, because we become even more vulnerable. And there are hints of this that we lived through and saw. In just like a 24-hour period, we nearly hit $1 billion of excess costs on our electricity market because of the spike in natural gas. And that happened, I don't know now, it's probably happened 6 years ago, 7 years ago. It's been controlled, but it's a very valid, very real thing. What was I talking about?
So the diversification or ownership of our sources is like a long-term affordability path. Yeah. But in the short term, dealing with the cards that we have, how do we, what's your answer to people who are struggling?
Okay. And let me just give one more example that kind of shows that there's hope by controlling it, by controlling the generation. And I'm not talking, we still need regionalization and fill in the gaps and all that stuff too. But the more we have in here, the more kind of supply side power we have. You know what I mean? And this was the benefit of having vertically integrated utilities was that they always had to bid into the market at the lowest cost. So that is actually something we need to talk about in terms of how the generation costs get further controlled. There's an opportunity there because the developers are maximizing their profit as well. Solar is maximizing their profit. They're not forced to, at least at this point, to always bid in low. That doesn't help their shareholders either. So there's the bad side of decoupling is that actually it's not as cheap. Even with the rate of return on capitalized infrastructure. So anyway, okay, so that's that. But the point I wanted to make actually was another COVID example. And the COVID example is that for 2 years, there was a moratorium on disconnections. And so when you think about how are we going to control this, these price increases, I just want to remind ourselves that we did the ultimate control during COVID. And we said nobody is getting disconnected. And it did not bankrupt the state. And it did not bankrupt the utilities. And people kept paying their bills for the most part. There was accrued arrearages. And we were very fortunate to have federal government relief that came through the states to pay off those arrearages. And that went directly to the utilities. And we can do it. And in that instance, we utilize federal funding. That was how we alleviated the economic time of COVID and made sure that nobody got disconnected. Okay, if you look around the world, and I haven't researched this, just in traveling and stuff like that, that there are countries that through their federal program subsidize energy. A lot of times you see this in Europe with natural gas, for example. And you know how, talk about why the strategy in Europe isn't about electrification 100%. Look at the dynamic we're in with Russia. Like, that's natural gas. You know what I mean? It's, if ever there was a reason to really go even further on our investments in our innovation in electricity, it's war. And there, we have been constrained in our thinking about affordability to just shifting ratepayers and how we can adjust amongst ratepayers. And I think that there's a real acknowledgement that, one, we need to get a hold of it moving forward, and the pace of increase needs to really slow down. And two is we need to spread these costs. Since the time I served, we approved through legislative mandate in large part for ratepayers to pay for the liability costs of wildfires.
Can I ask you a question on that? I was thinking about this in tandem with extreme heat in the Central Valley, and we collectivize the costs of wildfire exposure, but we don't collectivize the costs of extreme heat exposure. And they're, you know, two sides of the same coin in a lot of ways. Do you think that's something that's viable to distribute the costs of places like Fresno, where we have 30 to 60 days north of 100 degrees?
Of course, yes. I'm obviously biased in that. And it's kind of like water policy, where you're like, oh, you shouldn't be using this to grow that, or you shouldn't be. They're all value judgments. And I think one of the upcoming opportunities for that is the climate credit proceeding, which is essentially when the cap and trade program was reauthorized, and this happened the first time and the second time, the utilities don't put their sales revenue into the state's greenhouse gas reduction fund. They retain that revenue and they provide it as a dividend back to the ratepayers. And traditionally, that went back at a pro rata rate, if you want, or how do you want to say it? Like, basically, if you use more energy, you got more back, because essentially you had paid for that contamination more. And now the legislature has directed the PUC to redistribute that with an equity mindset. That's my word. That's not the language of the per se, but the opportunity is, and I want to, there's so many great people who are working on this. A lot of people in the Valley and some researchers, Stanford, Berkeley, people are writing about this opportunity to redistribute that in a more equitable way. And of course, the heat burdens that are faced by people in the Valley, one of a few areas of the state, deserve that relief. And so I hope that this proceeding that's underway really results in that. And in fact, I would say wholly in that. I don't think it's inappropriate for the climate credit to be just going to communities, that households that have this high heat burden. I think that's completely appropriate. If you have a $700 bill in the summer in Fresno for a family of four, and you should get that. And I think that's just as much as it's a moral, I don't know what you want to call it, a subjective question, as much as we allow people to use water and alfalfa and things like that. Same thing. It's a policy question. And I think that my friends in Santa Cruz shouldn't get the climate credit. That is what I believe. Yeah.
Do you think going forward that things like the climate credit are going to be the best tool to accomplish better affordability?
No, I think that's just a really, this is the opportunity before us. Yeah. And it's not insignificant. If it is actually tiered towards these communities, you could do it in a very extreme way. You could have relief like in the hundreds of dollars in the summer months for these communities. So it could be really significant. If at the sacrifice of all the other customers, of course, but that's where you're saying as a society that, you know, all the stuff we know all the time, we, by living in the Valley, just by working there, providing ag export economy, all of the stuff that you guys know better than anybody. It's, we need more people living in the valley. Like, it's a policy call.
You mentioned profits of some of the investor utilities a few minutes ago, and I just want to come back to that. That's come up in this conversation around affordability. And is there expect, so I guess two, maybe it's a two-part question. Do you feel like their expected or anticipated profits are too high for a lot of the investor-owned utilities? And what are the barriers to having more productive conversations about expected profits with the IOUs?
Yeah, one thing I want to, it's like your question right now on the climate credit, is that the solution to it all? No, but it's going to, it can make a real difference. I also just want to remind us all that it's an incredibly important conversation to have, even on just the, like what you're talking about earlier, George, and on like the moral question of should people be profiting it out at all out of a basic right? But it is in and of itself not the driver for the these historical increases. These increases are due to the liability of wildfires and the rebuilding of wildfires and the prevention of wildfires.
Yeah, if you lowered that 8% profit rate that PG&E has, would you be undercapitalized to prevent some, do the wildfire prevention stuff? Would the investors flock to more profitable outlets for their capital? Or do you think that wouldn't really affect the capital?
Well, it's not that easy. They can't just be like, we're not going to underground it or yeah, not going to harden these distribution lines. They have the, now with the advent of further governance here with the Office of Energy Infrastructure Safety, where they have to submit their wildfire management plans. They have outcomes, they have miles, their detailed plans, and they got to meet those obligations. No, I don't think it's going to drive it somewhere else. And in fact, I think we need to really almost give it, give that question the value that it has, which is just about what you said. It's in a range between 6 and 10, let's say. And that's huge, a huge reduction, but I just want us to not forget, like, we don't want to just like lower the return on equity and the cost of capital and the rate of return and think we're done. And so it's yes, and what else are we doing? Because that's not going to solve the whole problem. And also that I don't subscribe to this as somebody who leans more kind of democratic socialist. The example I gave you during the drought with the IOUs, like that was a financially driven incentive. They were going to build more pipelines for water and that was going to be capitalized. There is in the traditional American philosophy of economy and life, there is a role for incentivizing things, but I think the bigger role is in regulating them. So I think we need to come up with a more modest way, and I don't think it's going to deter them from financing. And I think that there's a lot of good questions right now that the legislature has put forward on how some of that infrastructure is financed and how the ownership of that infrastructure might even look different.
Let's, can we talk about public utilities now? Donnie, it was in 2022 that feasibility study was done by the city. Okay, so in 2022, there's a feasibility study done to see.
No, they never got as far as a feasibility study. They held a press. So we
had
council members hold a press conference in Fresno threatening to instigate a feasibility study to create their own public utility, and then they never made it.
Okay, thank you for that, for correcting my history. So we gestured at a feasibility study, but I guess my question is, how feasible do you think a public utility creation in a city like Fresno is, given the kind of infrastructure that would need to be purchased, the upfront costs, the bonds that would need to be passed by a city? Is that something that in your mind is feasible for a community like Fresno, or is that a pipe dream?
I think Fresno can do anything. So let me start there. Okay. We're talking about a region that has built tremendous amount of infrastructure, and there's many public utilities in the region. So you have the expertise. It's a little bit, I actually growing up in Sacramento, I remember there was a moment that the Sacramento Municipal Utility District was going to acquire, if not all of Yolo County, certainly where Davis and Woodland were and all that. And that they were there were initiatives on the ballot for the voters to authorize that in both counties, and it failed in Sacramento. And it's both a can we do it politically and can we do it physically question. And I think the more difficult thing today is that a lot of these assets that you would be acquiring are either in need of complete replacement or significant repair. And so you're coming in to buy an asset that is, you have to have a very long-term vision for the community there. And
you're buying an expensive car without a transmission.
Yeah. And it's, when I think about, but there was a, again, one of the most amazing parts of my last job at EPA was working with the tribal nations of the West. And there was a really great grant that was going to the Hopi Nation to build out a distribution infrastructure for them. And the, and then that was actually taken away by this administration, which is just, it's just a sin. But my point being is that the other real factor here, just as the CVP had a tremendous amount of federal investment and most of our major infrastructure didn't come at it alone, there's certainly a more viable pathway if the federal government wanted to make it. And that's also not out of the realm. It certainly is under this administration, but in the future. And then it's like, really, I'm just not a purist on it anymore, given the pros and cons I've seen in both models. But what I do know is that this rate of increase is too much. And so there's, as we deliberate on these maybe more systemic questions of governance, we got a lot we can do right now.
I guess to that point, beyond we have the climate credit discussion that's coming under the legislative package that was signed by Newsom earlier this year. And in the Valley, as on top of the weather issues that we have, we also have very old, deteriorating housing stock. And while there have been different funding programs that are supposed to help people upgrade and insulate and put in solar, the rate of participation on that is so minimal. And so I'm just curious, what's the most immediate next step that you think is necessary to immediately address the affordability issues that we see? Mm-hmm. I guess the last thing I'll say on that is PG&E does have the affordability program, and it's constantly oversubscribed, never having enough money to meet the need that we have.
Yeah, there's a lot there. I will just say, maybe going backwards, is that we have to protect the most vulnerable. We do have to maintain that as we go forward here and avert further people dealing with the disruption of disconnections. We know the ripple effect that has. And so we do need to have that intention as we move forward. There's a couple of programs that were piloted. One is the percentage of income payment plan, which basically is for really fixed income folks, mostly elderly, and just keep it simple. Whatever it is, $50 a month, they're not high users. Let's not overcomplicate it for these populations. There's also an arrearage management program that was piloted that is up for review and has some successes and some fixes that need to happen there. But the recognition that we're all better off if we allow people a pathway to continue paying, and the acknowledgement that the scenario of no payment is better, is the worst case for all of us. There's a lot of good work happening there. But the non-sexy thing is actually what I mentioned earlier, which I don't actually think it sounds so bureaucratic and that's not going to change anything. But I don't know if you've ever been like on a diet and you write down everything that you eat, or if you yourself have been on a tight budget or even a normal budget and you write down your monthly expenditures. And then at the end, you're like, okay, I'm $1,000 over. I got to really cut here. What am I cutting? That's what we need. And I think that level of transparency and discipline will have inherent benefits. And it doesn't sound very sexy. It's not cutting the profits directly from the cost of capital or anything like that, but it is a really important. And I think that there are huge building blocks in place for that. That obviously the general rate case is a huge one that gives that transparency and allows for those weighing the investments against another, but it's not enough. It's got to be everything. Okay. And, you know, of course, I don't know all the solutions. So to your big question, Danielle, there's many things that we should be doing. And I think that some of it has a delay because of the evidentiary process used at the commission that also may merit an expedited way of taking actions like that. I don't want to, it sounds so bleak, everything I just said, but essentially we set the system up, including, by the way, I'm going to say as a former commissioner, the ex parte rules. I went from the legislative setting where you're talking to everybody to come up with the best policy, right? You're really, you know that you don't know all the ins and outs of an issue and that you need to be better informed. And the more you talk to stakeholders, the better the policy is going to be. It's the complete opposite at the commission. It is not a participatory program. It's a judicial program. It's an evidence-based program. And I have studied economics. I have a master's in economics. I did some work in that field for a little bit. And you can always make up the result that you want. I'm not discrediting the field. I'm saying that you can create the data points even. When we think there's a belief that evidence is the only truth and that there's these facts that, but ultimately, even if you're narrowing it, which is a good part of the process, you still have to make a policy decision. And so the problem I see with the process that has become prohibitive for normal people to actually influence is that we put all these protections in place thinking that we were limiting the influence of the private utilities. And in fact, we have enhanced it because nobody else has five administrative staff to file the ex parte notice and file the report beforehand and file it after and schedule it and know. That's just one example that I think we have actually had the unintended consequence of trying to eliminate influence and have everything be on the record has actually limited the ability to engage people.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
One last question for you.
Yeah.
Out here in Fresno County, if you drive out on the west side, there's a solar farm popping up every month, it seems, and everyone's very happy about them. And I think I and a few other people have had this question of, you know, I know that there's processes in place for people to negotiate community benefits agreements, but what's the best that we could ever hope for as we see solar expansion in the Valley? Is there ever a world where the Valley can say, all of that cheap energy that's being produced on our land, we get to keep first and use to make our energy affordable? Or is that just thinking about the issue in a totally wrong way? I think I'm just curious, like, what's the best we could ever hope for as our cheap energy gets exported to the rest of the state?
Again, the irony of that is that if the utilities were vertically integrated, that would actually be more easily implementable. It's not the case. And as I said earlier, these developers, some of them are Valley owned and Valley based and may inherently have more interest in the return of investment into communities, but indirectly perhaps. And some of these developers, not only are they national or even multinational corporations that are providing energy for someone in the state and not in PG&E territory. I think there are some organizations that are really calling for that. Leadership Council, Central California Environmental Justice Network, and many others. I forget the group, but I'm forgetting the acronym of Jose Antonio Ramirez is involved with as well. I think it's a very timely question. It is possible, 100%. Absolutely. It needs a structure and needs the authority for it to happen, mostly through the commission. And It's possible. I think the valley is so unique because while we know, for example, statewide that like the distributed solar side, the rooftop solar has not benefited poor people, for example. So I think the last number I saw was like 8% of solar customers are low income. But actually, the valley as a whole has a lot of solar. And so we have this interesting dynamic there. But looking at the communities on the west side, they could benefit. They have not, I don't think I'm being inaccurate here in my description, in my own lived experience. I don't have data points on this. I could figure, you guys could fact check me on this, but they haven't benefited. In fact, I know one of the things I worked on with when Sarah Sharp was working with me is the fraud that was the predatory lending that was happening with distributed solar and people in Huron and Parlier. And there was like these targeted efforts to get, in some cases, two and a few, I remember three financing instruments that were used on individual homes. So anyway, this system power does not currently have a mechanism for direct benefit to Valley residents, but it could, absolutely could, and it absolutely should, especially given the way they have not benefited from distributed solar historically.
We conclude these podcasts each week with what we're loving. I'm going to go first. At the beginning of every December in Exeter, there is the Lind Cove Research and Extension Center's citrus fruit display and tasting, where you can go to Exeter, drive up into the hills, and taste a bunch of different citrus. It's incredible. I wasn't able to go this year. My wife went, and she stayed till the bitter end so she could bring me home some of the extra fruit that was there. And last night we had some friends over and we'd had a little citrus tasting in our living room. And she cut slices and we paired things. And it was a lot of fun. It's free to the public. This year I heard they even had like tents and heaters. And so you can just wander around. And I think last time it was something like more than 200 varieties of citrus that you could taste. So it's a super cool thing. And I want to broadcast it as much as possible because it's just a reminder of all the amazing things we can grow in the valley. So that's what I'm loving this week. Donnie, what about you? What are you loving?
Oh, this is a hard one. I don't know. I have a couple of things actually this week. So I have been trying to trudge through this book this fall about how the religious right and the political right have merged forces. But
What's it
it's been few.
called?
Oh, God, give me a
Is
second.
it Rick Perlstein or somebody else?
No, it's what's his name from The Atlantic?
Oh, I know who you're talking about.
You know
We'll
who I'm talking about.
find the title. We'll put it in the notes. Yeah.
Yeah, anyways, but it's been really heavy. And so I just had to set it down and find a different book to finish out the year because I just can't have too much heaviness right now. So I started reading The Art of Gathering by Priya Parker, which is lovely for December and is all about the wonkiness of what makes a good party.
So what
And
makes a good party a good party? Tell us.
she has a whole chapter on how to curate your guest list and politely exclude people.
Whoa, I need some notes on that.
And how you're actually doing people a favor by not inviting them,
Wow.
which it's intense.
Wow, that's
Anyways,
amazing.
yeah, she's a trip, so I've been enjoying that. And then also it's like cheesy movie season.
Oh, yeah.
And so I've used the cheesy movies. I just finished the Champagne Problems from Netflix while I was washing my dishes this
My
weekend.
wife watched that one this last week as well.
Oh, I haven't
Yeah,
heard that
Dash
yet.
and Lily is also on Netflix. That one's like a teeny bopper version of the cheesy Christmas movie. So my kids and I watched that one together. Yeah. Anyways, I can't handle anything heavy.
Oh
So
my gosh. Martha, what about you? What are you loving this week?
that's okay. I have a book club coming up. I have two events. Book club, where we're reading the Parable of the Sorrows. Was it?
Oh, sorry. That's been on my list for a long time.
Yeah, Octavia Butler's
Yeah, it's
incredible.
definitely not uplifting.
No.
Yeah.
It's a little bit like, oh,
It's too close to reality, no?
very close to reality, very close to reality, very close. And I'm scared to finish it. I'm like, please tell me some, please give me some hope here. So I have definitely not gotten to the hope part, but I'm hoping that's the case. But it's an amazing book, really, a lot of wisdom there. And then on Saturday, this will be our second tamal making party. And by the way, I should say my husband's really good about reminding people that there's tamales, which is plural, and there's tamal, which is singular. There's no such thing as a tamale.
Oh,
Okay, tamale? There's no tamale. It's just
really?
tamal.
Really? Okay.
Tamales. But that's like in California, everybody says tamale.
Exactly. Feel
What's
yeah.
Martha, what's your favorite kind of filling for a tamal?
Oh, I love the green chili and cheese. But my husband makes his mother's chicken recipe, which is like super yummy too. But I just love those green peppers, any kind of them, with cheese and goodness. So, yeah. So a lot of good eating this time of year. And I think it's culturally difficult to put some people off the invite list, but it's a good advice.
I feel like there are certain gatherings that you absolutely cannot exclude people. Family is probably one of them.
Don't get me wrong, all of my family's perfect, so I would always invite, for the record, all of
My family does do some strategic exclusion, and
oh.
it's never me. I'm always just sitting in the corner. That's an interesting choice.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, all the family side talk about who's coming and when. Do away with that. Martha, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you,
Thank
guys.
you.
It's good to really think about these things in this way. I appreciate all that you're doing and covering these important topics.
Yeah, thank you.
This has been Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom.
And this podcast was recorded at Sun Stereo Warehouse in downtown Fresno. Audio editing and mixing was done by Jordan Maddox. Our lead image comes from Vaughn Ballinan, and our song comes from Stateless Rat.